Hello and welcome to UX Maturity. This is a podcast about the challenges and joys of being a designer in the tech industry. I'm your co-host, Sandrine.
And I'm your co-host, Susan.
If you'd like to find out more about us, we are on Twitter at UX_maturity, and we also have a website at uxmaturitypodcast.com. If you have some time and would like to rate us, please do so on your podcast platform. It's always very helpful for us to know how we're doing. And we are doing episode 60 today on gathering insights. So we are doing our last topic on our insights theme. And this is also going to be the last theme episode of this season. Next week, we will be back for our final episode to wrap up the season. So let's dive in into our last topic, which is about gathering insights. Susan, maybe a good place to start for us could be to know maybe at what parts of the design process and at what parts in your project do you know when you need to gather some insights?
Great question. I'm, of course, very biased in this. If you're a longtime listener of the podcast, I think you should be gathering insights all the time, all the time. But if I try to ignore that bias, one sort of milestone, I suppose, when I feel like a lot of designers and teams feel like they should be gathering insights is in the beginning of something new. So typically a greenfield project, or if you're thinking of building something that's it's belonging to an existing product, but it's quite a substantial piece of work that involves a lot of complexity, or maybe you're trying to branch out and widen your intended audience. Maybe you're your core product has been targeting a specific type of user for a while, and you're thinking of expanding that group into another type of audience, and you want to learn more about them because you don't know much about them. Or it could be even after you've launched something, either a version 1 or a version 2, and you want to understand how well that's doing from a qualitative point of view. So it's not just in the beginning. It's also, I don't want to call it the end because it's not the end. It's not just in the beginning of the design process, it's also in the beginning of the delivery, shipping process, new process. And of course, also, if you can, gathering insights throughout the design process, but in sort of smaller chunks. You don't need to do a big, expansive research project in the middle of designing. But if you have questions, things you want to learn, and I encourage all designers to think about what is it that we want to learn, what are our assumptions, and how do we check if our assumptions are correct? Those questions should come to you throughout the design process. And every time they come up, think about how you might gather insights to figure that out. I feel like I went all the way around to you should gather insights all the time at the end.
Yeah, I find actually quite interesting that you are talking about gathering insights throughout the whole process. I was wondering you probably don't want to gather the same types of insights up front versus when you're getting into the solution space as well. So I'm actually quite keen to hear from you how do your insights gathering differ from when you start a project to when maybe you enter the solution discovery space as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to use a very high level example here, which is difficult to make specific, but hopefully it makes sense just to answer the question. In the beginning of the design process, the insights you tend to be interested in tend to be more around what is the problem space, what are the intended target audience's current workflow, what are their contexts, even what are they like. They're very high level conceptual stuff, more conceptual and contextual. So you kind of want to understand their world. You want to get insights into their world, their existing workflows, and that sort of thing. That comes in the beginning because that establishes the scaffolding or the foundation for your conceptual model that's going to drive your design. And as you go into more towards the converging phase of the discovery part, the initial discovery part, I think you're starting to focus more on different assumptions that came up in your initial insights gathering. And then you get a bit more laser focused, converging and laser focused on gathering insights to test those assumptions It could be, for example, you have two concepts to test, and you're after the initial discovery, you have two concepts to test, and your insights are more which of these concepts resonate more with users. And then as you move into the solution space, again, this is a very simplified example, simplified way of looking at it. As you move into the solution stage, I think the insights you're more interested in are more the nitty-gritty details, like, is this usable? Or maybe you have two, three different solutions you're exploring and you want to understand which one is more usable or which one is more valuable. They're more focused on the solutions themselves and gathering insights on how your intended target audience is responding to the solutions rather than gathering insights on the intended target audience's world. So it's as you move throughout the design process, in my experience, it tends to start with being focused on insights about the people and then progressively more towards gathering insights about how those people respond to your potential solutions. Long-winded answer, but that's an outline of how I tend to think about it.
Yeah, no, I think it makes sense. I think I've talked about this in the previous episodes where we talked about the solution discovery. But I think for me, there's a big insight gathering as well as you move from the converge phase, you know, of like defining opportunities. And then once you prioritize what opportunity you want to focus on, you're going back into diverge space. And usually that's where you go and explore, ideate a lot. But actually, often I actually go back a bit to research, not research particularly with, you know, primary research to users and all that, but I will do a lot of exploration around how is that opportunity being solved right now? What mental models do people have? And all of these insights are more, I guess, related to interaction models and, you know, how they expect web conventions and all of these sort of things, how they expect things to work. Or is there like competitors or people that kind of do something similar? They don't have to be a competitor, but someone who does something like a little bit related, who does it in a specific way and it works for them and potentially could be transferred to us as well. So I do usually quite a lot of research around this to figure out the multiple ways that, yeah, a problem can be solved or has been solved. And then I make sure I absorb those insights into my own approach as well when I'm developing new concepts and so forth.
Yeah, I agree. That's also a very good point that insights gathering isn't just talking directly to users. It's, like you said, competitor research and also just not just researching competitors, but researching what other types of technology or brands or, you know, what occupies the intended target audience's mind space. What are they, you know, what does their landscape of tech and digital look like? So it's all a big part of insights gathering as well. Of course, this depends on where you are in the process and what kind of, you know, what kind of insights you're interested in gathering. But how do you get started?
Yeah, great question. I guess it depends, again, what step of the project you're in, but I'm going to consider that you're starting from the beginning where you've just been given a challenge, a piece of data, a piece of insights or business problem, whatever it is really you're starting from. Usually I like to start by gathering what I know about the problem space, because obviously that's the easiest place to start. And I try to basically bring everything in the same place, all the knowledge that I have, my team has, stakeholders have in a business, and that the business has as well. So it can be past research documents, so yeah, secondary research, it can be quant analysis, it can be conversations with stakeholders as well. It can be my own audit you know, if I'm working on an existing product, I can just do an audit, a heuristic analysis of the flow that we're looking at. It can be, yeah, past learnings from past tests, loads of things. So you usually can gather already quite a bunch of insights or at least data points from all of this. And from that, what's usually quite interesting is that you start coming up with more questions. So you're like, okay, so we know this, but we don't know that. Or you might like be wondering, okay, like we have this data that shows us this, but I wonder why this happens. And you start slowly kind of building and adding questions to the side. And usually that's how I get to, add basically questions that we haven't answered. So I guess the unknowns. And I start putting them on the side and building them up. And then over time, after a while, I start seeing, I guess, some themes in those questions. And that's when I'm starting to say, okay, we have some big research questions that we want to explore. And so usually I would have kind of, I would highlight those big research questions. So for example, it could be, I want to deep dive into what perception, how do people perceive the value of this feature, for example, or like, how would they get value from X? Or I don't know, it could be very broad. And then from there, I would start detailing really more narrow questions from there. So that's when I would start then slowly building a bit more of a detailed research questions, I guess, from there. So I know exactly what kind of insights, what kind of information I'm after. Obviously, depending on if you have a research team to work with or not, this step is more or less fast, like straightforward. I tend to like collaborating also with research because they have tons of expertise to bring in terms of framing the research, framing the right questions, choosing the right methodology. But sometimes you have to do without because you don't always have a research capability in your team. So yeah. But there's tons of great resources online to support on this. So yeah, so I start with what I know and then slowly go to what I don't know. I think the hardest is the unknown unknowns, but I tend to not over-focus on this and just accept it as part of the ambiguity of the discovery process and that eventually those unknowns will make themselves known. Or, you know, try to at least limit the risk of a big unknown basically really sending us off track. But for most projects, this doesn't happen. This is really for highly risky projects that a big unknown would be difficult to deal with.
Nice. Yeah, we have very, very similar processes, I think. To add to it, I think I actually tend to start with the objective. And that's just because I've usually been working in startups that have OKRs of some sort. So it's usually something overarching, an objective overarching, driving the focus for my squad that quarter. Because me being me and being just very curious about people, like if I'm left to my own devices, I'll just like spend all day talking to users and learning all the things without any focus, just because I'm interested. So I need that kind of laser focus from an objective to keep me a bit directed. So I tend to let the objective guide me, and then I ask myself questions in a similar way that you do. I think I tend to start with what's the objective, and then question dump a bunch of questions from my brain, usually in the doc or Miro board, of all the types of questions I can think of that will help me move towards the objective. And then again, like what you do, I tend to pile through all the knowledge that already exists. So if I'm lucky enough to work in a place that has lots of synthesized research, lots of insights already, then I comb through those, whether they're research decks or research repository or recordings. Sometimes, and I love doing this, I love working in cross-functional squads with customer-facing team members. So people in customer success or customer support or in operations, they'll have so much knowledge. And so I'll tend to run little huddles and workshops with them to get answers to my initial question dump out of their heads, stakeholder workshops and that sort of thing. And yeah, essentially like what you described, kind of mapping out, okay, this is all everything I know. Hopefully I've knocked off 70-80% of the questions I initially had, which is great because you don't want to gather insights that already exist, because that's redundant. So you want to focus on the knowledge gaps, and then identify the knowledge gap, and then yeah, figure out research questions and a research plan, either with or without user researchers. Another thing to add is I really enjoyed working in places that has a strong data analysis or product analytics function, because that's not my strength at all. I'm not quant focused. So if I have a question, if I have a research question that's more quant focused, I love it when I can just go to a Slack channel or go to a team member and ask them that question, like a team member who is in product analytics or in data analysis, and they'll just take my brief, take my question, or we'll have a bit of back and forth trying to understand what it is I'm trying to learn. And either they've already analyzed a bunch of things and they already have the answer to me, or they go away and they do their magic and come back with lots of interesting insights after having crunched the data. So that's another way of insights gathering, right? You don't always have to go to users or pile through lots of written information or do desk research. You can also ask your colleagues who are closer to specific types of data.
I also find that I've kind of observed two different approach to insight gathering, and maybe you observe the same thing. I'm quite curious about it. I tend to be more question driven, so I would be as like you ask a lot of questions, and then I will literally just go and try to find answers for my questions. I've observed some designers, or mostly designers, I haven't worked with a researcher who has done that, but there's probably some of what as well who do the same, who are more, I guess, validation driven, I guess, almost. So they will start with like hypotheses or assumptions, and they will sometimes map out a flow of what they think is going on from a user perspective in their mind based on what they know of the problem. And then they will go and seek to validate that or disprove it. So I guess when they disprove it, that's when they get as well new themes, new insights, like we would as well when we ask questions. But it's like, it's almost like they are, yeah, trying to invalidate or validate basically an approach or a flow or a journey. And I find that quite interesting, where for me, it's like these people must kind of approach the research or the discovery or the gathering of insights in almost a flipped way compared to me. It's like they have something in mind and they try to go towards it or to prove it or to disprove it. Whereas for me, I kind of go a bit in the dark, and then I get to a place that has a more defined answer by the end. So we tend to obviously get to a similar place in the end, which is obviously an opportunity statement. But I found it really interesting how they get there in a very different way.
Yeah, I think there are different similar conceptual frameworks of how to think about this. I think on the one hand, you have generative research and generative insights gathering, which is that sort of bottom-up approach going into the dark that you described, where you start with not having a thing like a solution or a flow, and then you kind of learn your way into something that eventually becomes the flow. And then the other end of that spectrum, the opposite end of generative research, is evaluative research, which mm-hmm. is where you have a thing and you want to evaluate it, you want to test it. Some people call it assumptions testing, some people call it validating a design or validating a flow. I tend to avoid saying validating an assumption, because it has a bit of inherent bias in it. Mm-hmm. You're seeking to validate, confirm your assumption. But you know, it's a similar type of thing. I don't think they're two different approaches in the same problem space necessarily. I think they're two different approaches to take depending on where you are in the process. But maybe to what you described, maybe some designers start a bit too quickly with testing a solution without having explored the problem space before, and maybe other designers start too far back, take too many steps back, and then are too open-ended, when actually it can start a bit further down the design process and test something specific. So part of this is also knowing what level of fidelity to start with, I suppose.
Yeah, although I guess what I'm referring to is that I have a person in mind, but that person was not really particularly seeking to validate a solution. It was more like they had a set of hypotheses, of assumptions based on what they think is from a user perspective. Yeah, and then they would go and seek to, prove or disprove it. But then they would be totally open to it being disproved, and then they would carry on with that as well. So it's not like they were locked in a solution. It was more, I guess, more hypothesis, assumptions around where the user stands based on their own understanding. So at least they felt like they were starting from somewhere, which was quite interesting. But yeah, anyway, I'm just rambling now.
No, it does sound a lot like hypothesis-driven design, which was a bit of a hot topic a few years back. Not to say it's out of date, but I remember it just sort of hypothesis-driven design blossomed up as a thing a few years ago. But then my question is, wouldn't they have done some insights gathering to get to the hypotheses in the first place? Like, where did the hypotheses come from?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it mostly came from the understanding built over time. So I guess from a lot of secondary research. So it does come from some form of insights from users. So it doesn't come from nowhere. But there was also, I guess, a layer of understanding over the audience that came from, I guess, naturally working with the audience over time as well. So yeah, it's just very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. I did work in a place that was very hypothesis focused. And it was the first time I had worked in a place like that. So I had to kind of reframe the way I thought about things, because like you, I tend to start with research questions. Yeah, I think maybe it depends a bit on just the culture, the product and design culture of the place you are. Do you have thoughts on who should be involved in gathering insights?
From my perspective, it should be mainly mainly the team, as in mainly the product manager, the designer, and the researcher, if there is a researcher present. I think the researcher would tend to be here more to support in terms of primary research, or help lead to and point to past research that was done. I think the designer and the PM still have a huge part to play in gathering insights in terms of quants, stakeholder interviews sometimes as well, just auditing, you know, all of these sort of things. I wouldn't rely on the researcher to do this, because obviously researchers are mostly focusing on gathering primary data, and that's obviously already very time consuming. So I think I would expect these three people to be involved actively. Obviously product analyst or data analyst might be involved when quant is being requested, obviously, but I think I've rarely seen data analysts being fully embedded into a team. So usually they will come in as a ad hoc basis when they are needed, basically, which usually would be on request of from the PM or from the designer. So I think that trio of PM, designer and research are the main drivers for gathering insights. And I would expect as well them to be analyzing insights together as well. I never really believe that only one person can be interpreting and analyzing insights. I think the designer should be absolutely involved into that part. And I wouldn't usually leave that just to the researcher. I'd always want to be involved in that part, just because it helps you absorb the data, the insights, get closer to your audience, getting to know the problem. And as a designer, that's invaluable and you need to have that. And it feels like if you're part of the analysis, then you kind of have to go over most of the data that you've gathered, and you can draw conclusions yourself, but also you just remember, it will be in your memory that you've gone over those.
Yeah, I'm very in favor of it, the analysis and insights gathering to be a collaborative thing as well between, well, this is heavily going to depend on who's in a team, but from my experience, it's been me as a designer and a product manager and a very product focused tech lead, or it has been me and a product manager and a customer operations team member. So, and that person usually, you know, they know everything that goes in the user's heads because I talk to them every day, or a researcher, me and a PM and a researcher. And I'm very, very in favor of synthesizing and analyzing insights together as well, because we bring different perspectives into the analysis. So me with the design UX perspective, product manager with more, you know, of course UX as well, but also more of a business requirements perspective, and a tech lead, if there is one, with more of a technical, pragmatic, pragmatic view, but also an opportunistic perspective on things. I have worked in places where we did have dedicated user researchers, and then they would sometimes do the analysis themselves if it was a very, very complex, sophisticated piece of research where, you know, it just went advanced analysis. And that's a level of analysis I wouldn't be able to do because I've never been a proper user researcher. So that's an exception, I guess. And then similar to my data analyst example earlier, they will typically sit there in their SQL, doing their SQL magic and analyze without me. But in general, yeah, I like the cross-functional exercise of it.
Yeah, I've in my current role, actually, we have some product ambassadors, and I don't know if you've ever worked with these people, and that was quite new for me, but they are someone kind of sitting, if I understand it well, they're kind of sitting between the customer operation, customer support and product. So they kind of like are that bridge where they know the product in and out, but they're also very much in touch with what people are complaining about or what they struggle with, and they are very much on top of customer support requests, and they can inform product quite regularly about how the system works and also what blocks the user. And I thought they were a really great person to also reach out to whenever you start diving into anything. You can kind of pick their brain and ask if do users struggle with any of this? Do we have, you know, specific complaints regarding this that keep coming back? And they would usually be the person you can go to. So yeah, I thought that was really interesting to have that person at hand.
I've never worked in a place with product ambassadors, but I think I've seen some people with that title, and they also, to an extent, it's not the same thing, but they remind me a little bit of developer relations, DevRel people, which are kind of, they sit between, so these are typically for products that are aimed at developers. So they sit between development, engineering, and a little bit of growth and a little bit of customer success. So they're, you know, they're a bit, they're technical, but customer facing, and a little bit of marketing as well. So they sit at all those cross sections, and they have so much insights about the audiences and the users as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they would be, yeah, they would be supporting and helping alignment between different functions, and also making sure that, yeah, new releases also have the appropriate help content. I think sometimes they also help out with this. So yeah, it's, yeah, just very helpful people to have in your team, for sure.
And to add to all of these people, if you're in an environment with a strong sales function, then the sales people are a gold mine of insights as well. I find that some designers tend to have a bit of an antagonistic relationship to salespeople, kind of like working in a bit of a silo away from sales. And in my experience, salespeople have been some of my best insights sources when I worked in a company, because they talk to prospects all the time. So I very much recommend building strong relationships with the salespeople in your org as well, if you have them.
Yeah, I agree. I think the ambivalence of the relationship sometimes is because salespeople would tend to tell you what people want, which is not always what they need. And I think that rings that little red bell in every designer's mind of being like, be careful, people don't always, you know, they don't always know what they want, and what they say isn't always matching that. But I do agree with you, though, that salespeople do talk to clients and customers every day. And I think it depends what kind of business you're working on as well. Like, sometimes salespeople actually sell the product to, not to the end user as well. So actually, you have to be mindful and take note of that. Do they actually talk to the end user or not? But sometimes they do talk to the end user, and that's when it gets very interesting, where you can hear a little bit more about, I guess, yeah, how do people, what kind of challenges do these people actually face, and how does our product proposition fit into this? What is it currently missing? And, you know, what value do they find in our competitors as well? What does make people switch away from our products? What makes them win them over as well? And all of these things are really great insights into how we bring value as product designers as well. I don't think you should ever take it up front of, like, you know, sometimes you'll see customers always saying, I want this, like, make this feature. And I think you obviously always need to take that with a pinch of salt. But it always tells you, though, about, okay, we have that feature request quite often. What are people actually trying to achieve here? And sometimes they're requesting something that is feasible and that you should, you know, bring to your product. Sometimes you need to scratch below that surface a little bit and extract the problem, and that's when you can actually sometimes create something quite meaningful for your audience as well. So yeah, I wouldn't dismiss at all what the commercial team has to say, for sure. It's just, yeah, being mindful, obviously, of not taking everything at face value.
Yeah, completely agree. And that's a great example with feature requests. Like, feature requests in and of themselves aren't insights, it's just a data point, and then it's our job as designers and researchers and the product team to figure out what's the context around these feature requests? What other insights are there around the feature requests?
Yeah, and I think sometimes there's a bit of frustration from design, because I guess some companies are more commercially driven. So I guess there's that attitude of, like, building what the customer demands or asks for. And I guess there's not that diligence of, like, you know, going through the actual request and figure out why you should actually do this. And sometimes there's a bit of a competitor catch-up behavior happening, or being like, well, competitors do this, so we need to do this as well. And it's like, we all know that focusing on what your competitors do and trying to catch up on them is the worst thing you can potentially do. But sometimes, you know, you work for a company that is actually design user driven, and then in next case, salespeople actually really love selling the product that they sell because they believe in the product as well. They believe in the value it provides, and they actually listen. They tend to listen to customers quite well. So usually they have a slightly different attitude to also how they bring up issues. And often I see them, they bring up more problems sometimes as opposed to just pure feature requests as well. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah. So some of the best salespeople I've been surrounding myself with have a very analytical mind, and they're very curious about the people they're trying to sell to. So they'll often bring to the rest of the organization or to the design team or a product team, like often a wall of text, like, oh, I spoke to this prospect and they were describing their workflow, and then they go through and describe their workflow, and then the salesperson might have analyzed the situation. It's like, oh, this matches what a lot of other prospects said. I wonder why. So, you know, some salespeople are very analytical and they understand psychology very well. So it's very valuable to have great salespeople around.
Yeah, absolutely. To bring us back into the topic of gathering insights.
We love sales.
I was wondering what typical mistakes do people make actually when gathering insights, and how can we avoid them as well?
Yeah, great question. I think one mistake people often make, and I'm guilty of it myself, is I gather insight with, similar to what we talked about earlier, I gather insight with a view to validate something I already believe. So I'm being a bit led by confirmation bias, and that it's very difficult to not be led by confirmation bias, because it's, you know, as a designer, you care and you have opinions. You can't, it's just unavoidable to have opinions. And so in those situations, I think it's very valuable to really have, for example, if you're lucky and have a user researcher in your company or more, to have them look at your research proposal, have a sort of almost like outsider view to help you frame your research proposal and research questions properly. They're excellent. That's part of why they're there. They're excellent at that. And another mistake I see is, well, almost like one of two things, like that people gather insights too late in the process. So they only start gathering insights when they're usability testing something and haven't, you know, they've already built something already designed something. And the first time you talk to users and gather the insights is when you want to test the thing you've designed. And then the other end of that is when you start gathering insights too early and you haven't gone through that process we described, where we mapped out what are our questions and what do we already know. In other words, making the mistake of going out to gather insights we already have in an organization.
Yeah.
How about you? What other mistakes do you see?
Yeah, that last one actually kind of resonated a bit with me. I have there's been times where we were starting to write a research plan, and then we looked at the questions and we're like, we've already researched this. And it's not that we got answers that we wanted, but we've already researched it. And like we already know a lot, and then, you know, going about it with this angle, we would probably get the same insights again. So then it's kind of nice actually to have that reality check. So then you're like, okay, we need to reframe our research questions. Or are we actually seeking to solve something we've tried to solve and, you know, weren't successful at solving? Then we need to maybe ask different questions and so forth. So that's definitely one. I think there's some basic gathering, like, research mistakes that are being made, like leading questions sometimes, and really like kind of leading people into telling you things so that the end result is biased, so you can't actually rely on it. I think sometimes we forget as well that when you gather insights, you are catching people in a different environment than they would normally be in as well, and sometimes not really applying that layer of perspective, I guess, that, you know, people that are usability testing your designs are paying extra attention to everything and they are reading everything, but they would normally not do that in real life. Or when they are, you know, sitting with you to have a conversation, obviously they will go in depth into your topic and all that. But, you know, when they are playing with your product, they don't think that hard about things. So it means that some pieces of information need to be more easily available and so forth. So it's like kind of not, I guess, yeah, it's just applying a bit of perspective regarding the test environment or the research environment that you're also having them in. another one for me, and it's a big one for some team, it's always rely on the same type of insights, same type of data, which is completely dismissing qualitative data often, and just relying on tests, mindlessly testing their way to something, testing very, very small changes to try to create a big change in behavior, which often cannot get you there because you don't understand why the behavior in the first place is not happening. So just focusing on quants, it's for me sometimes a big mistake that happens. People just forgetting that the quant doesn't tell you why. Why is the quant that way? You cannot tell from it. It only tells you what happens. And it's super valuable to know what happens. You can do amazing analysis on behavior on your product and detect opportunities and all that. I am fully supportive of this. I love working with good product analysts. But to understand why it's happening, you need to go to talk to people. That's the only way. So I think that happens quite often. And I think the last one for me is more related to the analysis of insights. But for me, it's very important that there's more than one person in the room. And it's very important that you have a diverse team to look at those insights. So many people underestimate actually that they don't spot something in the data. They don't listen to people the same way. Like just try that out. You should always have a note taker with you when you're doing a user interview. After the interview, you should always have a debrief, and you will, like, almost every time, there will always be one piece of information that stood out for someone and it did not stood out for you. And that's because you don't listen the same way, you don't spot the same things. Some things don't matter to you, but they matter to others. And diversity in here is key because, you know, culture, gender, all of this, it all benefits to us seeing things differently. So I think our layer of interpretation over the data is going to be different. And if you don't even bring the right data into the room for analysis for your insights, because you've deemed that some things were not important, but actually they probably were, then you're in a big problem. So yeah, make sure that you have more than one person looking at the same data points, especially when you're gathering insights. And if you have a diverse team, it's obviously a lot better as well.
Preach. big plus one. Always a proponent of having a diverse team. And to extend that point, I also think it's hugely important and very often neglected to gather insights from a diverse range of people. I find that this is one of the biggest mistakes people make when they gather insights so let's say you're recruiting people for user interviews and almost everyone are the similar age, similar gender identity, maybe similar socioeconomic background, they're all white. It's often because I think it's easier for certain demographic groups to sign up for research in the first place. It's a privilege to have spare time to sign up for research. And if you don't, I'm not saying you always absolutely must incentivize people for research, but if you're not incentivizing people for research, then it's also a privilege to be able to take time out of your day and do research for free for a company. So yeah, I don't think we think about these things enough as an industry of how important it is for us to do the hard work of reaching people that are hard to reach, people with three jobs, people with single parents with five kids. You know, these are also the people we're designing for. So yeah, I'm getting a bit very passionate about this, but I don't see enough of that. And I wish people would think more deeply about it.
Okay, so I think we've gone around the topic of gathering insights quite well. We've talked quite a bit about how we go about gathering them and what other must do, I guess, to gather insights. How often do they happen throughout the design process, and also what are the key mistakes to avoid. And we can jump in into our segment, which is about what we're grateful for. So Susan, what are you grateful for this week?
I'm grateful for family and that I get to see them soon, because they're all both my family and my partner's family are coming to London for the festive celebrations in December. So we're all going to be together. And I'm extra grateful these days because I finished a book called Takeaway by, I'm not sure if she's a Vice reporter anymore, but she used to be a Vice reporter and she used to cover like food culture and food journalism and stuff. Her name is Angela Hui. And she writes in Takeaway, she writes a memoir about growing up in a Chinese takeaway. And it was such an emotional read because I grew up in a Chinese restaurant and it's the whole book and the whole concept of being a Chinese person growing up in a Chinese restaurant in a Western country is so much about family and identity to me. And yeah, it just made me really grateful for my family, for my upbringing. It made me grateful for having grown up in a Chinese restaurant. And I'm extra grateful that they're coming to London this at the end of the year.
So nice. On my side, I am flying to France for a long weekend, and I'm very grateful that I'm gonna get to see my two best friends from France. I haven't seen them in quite a while, so yeah, we're going to celebrate because this year is quite special to the three of us. So yeah, it's gonna be a really fun weekend, and it's looking like it's gonna be very warm and sunny. So yeah, really looking forward to it, and see them again. So yeah, grateful for friends. All right, so this concludes episode 60 on Gathering Insights. And as I said at the beginning of the episode, this was our very last episode on the theme this season. We will be back next week for a very final episode on season 3. We'll be, I guess, wrapping up the season and talking about, I guess, I don't know, reminiscing what we enjoyed, etc. during the season. And we will be back at some point for a fourth season, hopefully. So yeah, we will see you next week. And as always, you can find us on Twitter at UX_maturity or on our website at UXmaturitypodcast.com. And yeah, see you next week.